A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's a failure cascade that kept me up at night. Our producer sent in his own recent home network nightmare. A server rebuild, ZFS pool failure, and a cascading service collapse that I think a lot of people who run home labs or small business infrastructure have experienced but rarely talk about. The core of it is this. His Proxmox host died, taking down both the DNS server and the Unify controller with it. Now DNS is gone, clients can't resolve anything, and the controller that could update them is also down because it was on the same box. Classic chicken and egg problem. The prompt asks whether the obvious fix, just decouple everything onto its own physical hardware, actually makes sense, or whether there's a practical middle ground between a catastrophic single point of failure and a sprawling rack of Raspberry Pis that's unmanageable. So where do we even start with this?
Let's start with the cascade itself, because the specific failure mode matters. ZFS pool corruption is one of those things that happens more often than people admit. We talk about ZFS like it's data invincibility made into a file system, and for bit rot protection, it genuinely is excellent. What it doesn't protect against is controller firmware bugs, a bad SATA cable with intermittent errors, or power supply noise corrupting pool metadata in flight. I've seen a single flaky SATA cable take down an entire pool. The drive itself is fine. The ZFS checksums are theoretically solid, but the controller is feeding garbage to the pool layer, and ZFS can't tell the difference between a real disk error and a transport error. It just sees checksum mismatches, panics, and then you're in recovery mode hoping your metadata isn't scrambled.
It's worth pausing on that SATA cable example because it's so insidious. I had a case a few years back where a server would throw ZFS checksum errors roughly once every 3 weeks. No pattern, no correlation with load, no smart errors on any drive. Replace drives one at a time. Problem persisted. Replace the HBA. Problem persisted. Turned out to be a SATA cable that had been ever so slightly crimped during initial build. Not enough to fail outright, just enough that when thermal expansion hit the right temperature range, the impedance changed and the signal degraded. That cable cost $4. It wasted probably 40 hours of diagnosis across 2 months. And during those 2 months, every time the pool threw errors, there was a non-zero chance of metadata corruption that would have taken down every VM on that host.
That's a perfect illustration of why single points of failure aren't always where you think they are. Everyone worries about disk failure because it's the obvious one. Almost nobody thinks about the cable connecting the disk to the controller. And the thing about pool metadata corruption is it doesn't take down one VM. It takes down every VM relying on that storage. So from the perspective of your network, it's not a server with a problem. It's the DNS server, the controller, the reverse proxy, monitoring, and whatever else was running all vanishing simultaneously. That's the particular nightmare here. It's not that one service died, it's that all the ones you rely on to diagnose and fix the problem died together.
You can't even search for the error message because your DNS is down and the browser just spins.
Right, and that brings us to the DNS piece specifically. DNS is the most quietly critical service on any network. Every other service depends on name resolution. Home Assistant can't pull updates. Your monitoring system can't resolve the alerting webhook endpoint. You can't SSH into the main server using a hostname. If you've got certificate validation happening internally, that breaks too, because it can't resolve the CA. Even accessing your Git repository to pull a backup script might fail. DNS stops working, and suddenly your network isn't just impaired, it's actively hostile to recovery.
I want to double-click on that certificate validation failure because it's one of those knock-on effects that nobody sees coming. Let's say you're running an internal certificate authority, something like Stepka or Smallstep, and all your internal services use TLS with certificates issued by that CA. When DNS goes down, your services can't resolve the CA's hostname to check certificate revocation status. Depending on how you've configured OCSP stapling or CRL distribution points, that can mean services start refusing TLS connections, not because the certificates are invalid, but because they can't verify they're still valid. So now you've got a situation where even services that are still running can't talk to each other. DNS failure cascades into TLS failure, and you're debugging certificate errors when the root cause is name resolution. It's maddening.
The worst part is the error messages give you zero indication that DNS is the culprit. You get TLS handshake failures, connection refused errors, timeout messages, none of which say, hey, maybe check if your DNS server is alive. You end up chasing ghosts in the certificate chain for an hour before you think to run INS lookup and realize nothing resolves.
This is where the Unify controller dependency becomes the 1-2 punch. The access points themselves keep running with their cache configuration, so your Wi-Fi doesn't immediately drop. But they can't adopt new devices, they can't receive config changes, they can't update firmware. And here's the specific loop from the prompt. You need to push new DNS settings to clients so they can resolve again. But to push those changes, you need the controller. To restore the controller, you need DNS to resolve the repository or the backup location, and the controller was on the dead host. You're stuck.
The Unify controller is particularly sneaky in this regard because it doesn't announce itself as a critical dependency until you're in a failure. When everything's working, it hums along and you forget it exists. When it's gone, you realize your entire wireless management plane evaporated and your backup config file is on a ZFS volume that won't mount. I have seen people spin up a temporary controller on a laptop, adopt the APs fresh, manually recreate the SSIDs and VLANs, and then reprovision everything, a process that takes hours and requires you to remember every setting that was in there.
You'd better hope you remembered whether VLAN 20 was guest or IoT, and whether the guest network had client isolation enabled, and what the minimum data rate control was set to. Those are settings you configure once and never think about again. Reconstructing them from memory at 11 p.m. on a Tuesday is not a position you want to be in.
What's the actual procedure for that laptop recovery? Walk me through it. Because I think people here just spin up a temporary controller and don't realize what they're signing up for.
Right, so step one, you install the Unify controller software on a laptop. Step two, you realize the laptop can't reach the internet to download it because DNS is down, so you tether to your phone. Step three, you install it, fire it up, and it sees zero access points because the APs are still looking for the old controller. Step four, you now have to SSH into each access point individually, which requires knowing their IP addresses, which you may not have documented because DNS always handled that, and run the set inform command to point them at the laptop's IP. Step five, the APs connect, but they show up as managed by other because they still think they belong to the old controller. Step six, you factory reset each AP through SSH, adopt them fresh, and manually recreate every SSID, every VLAN assignment, every wireless uplink configuration, every radio setting. For a house with three APs, that's maybe 2 hours if you know what you're doing. For a small office with eight APs and complex VLAN segmentation, you're looking at half a day. And the entire time, your family or your colleagues are asking when the Wi-Fi will be back.
That's the optimistic scenario where you actually remember all the settings. The realistic scenario involves a lot of, was the IoT network on VLAN 20 or VLAN 30? And did we have band steering enabled? And what was the DTIM period set to for the VoIP SSID? These are not things normal humans commit to memory.
That's the mess. Now let's talk about the obvious solution, the one raised in the prompt. Just give every critical service its own physical box. DNS on one Raspberry Pi, Unify controller on another, Home Assistant on a third, reverse proxy on a fourth, MQTT broker on a fifth, monitoring on a sixth, and you still need something to act as a bastion host. Six Pis, six power adapters, a switch with enough ports to handle them all, six SD cards, six things to keep updated. For your average home user or a small business without dedicated IT, that's not resilience. It's a part-time job you didn't apply for.
The SD card problem alone makes this approach deeply questionable for anything you want to treat as reliable infrastructure. Based on Backblaze data and lab benchmarking, Raspberry Pi SD cards have a median lifespan of 2 to 3 years under write-heavy loads. Pi-hole itself isn't write-heavy, but if you're running a UniFi controller or a monitoring stack that's logging continuously, you're chewing through write cycles. An SD card failure on a Pi is often silent. You don't get smart data, you don't get pre-failure warnings, you just show up one morning and the device is offline. So now you've got 6 single board computers, each with its own failure pattern, each representing a single point of failure for a specific service.
There's a subtlety here that I think deserves attention. When you have one server and it fails, everything fails at once. That's bad, but at least you know immediately. When you have 6 Pis, they fail one at a time, randomly, over the course of months. You don't notice the third one died until you need that specific service. It's death by 1,000 paper cuts. You trade one catastrophic failure event for a constant low-grade stream of minor failures, and I'm not convinced that's actually better from a quality of life standpoint.
The single server failure is a crisis you can rally around and fix. The distributed Pi failure pattern is a persistent background hum of entropy that slowly erodes your will to maintain the home lab at all.
Let's actually price it. A Pi 5 with a case, power supply, and a decent SD card runs about $80. Multiply by 6, you're at $480. Add a managed switch that can handle VLANs, another $100. That's nearly $600, and you still don't have anything approaching actual resilience, because if any one of those PIS goes down, its service is gone until you physically intervene.
What would an enterprise do? That's worth understanding, if only to see why it doesn't translate directly. An enterprise deploys virtualization with high availability clustering. Think VMware vSphere with vSAN or Proxmox with Ceph for shared storage. You run at least 3 identical nodes. If one node fails, the other 2 see it's gone and they automatically restart its VMs. Storage is replicated across all nodes, so no single disk failure brings anything down. The connection between nodes is at least 10 gigabit, preferably 25, to keep storage replication from becoming a bottleneck. You've got redundant networking, separate management interfaces, redundant power distribution.
All of that comes with a price tag that would make a small business owner gently close the laptop and pretend they never asked. A 3-node refurbished Dell Optiplex or HP Elite Desk Cluster with the networking to pull off Ceph Shared Storage, even using used hardware, runs between $3,000 and $5,000 for entry level. That's before you factor in the time to configure Ceph, tune it for the workload, document your failure procedures, and maintain it. For a home lab or a small medical practice or a law firm with 5 employees, that's not a reasonable ask. You're trading one problem, single point of failure, for another problem, complexity, you don't have the bandwidth to manage.
See, specifically, is not something you casually configure on a Saturday afternoon. It's an extraordinarily capable distributed storage system, but it has a learning curve that looks like a cliff. You need to understand placement groups, crush maps, OSD weighting, and the implications of different replication factors. Get any of those wrong, and you've built a system that's less reliable than a single ZFS pool, not more. I've seen home labbers spend weeks tuning Ceph only to discover that their consumer-grade switch introduces enough latency under load to cause periodic quorum issues, and now they're debugging network microbursts instead of actually using their home lab.
Neither the piss everywhere approach nor the enterprise cluster approach fits the use case. The real question becomes, what does practical resilience actually look like when you're not a Fortune 500 company with dedicated SREs? And I think the answer is something I'd call tiered resilience. The core insight is that not all services are equally critical, and you shouldn't spend the same money or mental overhead protecting all of them.
This is the part where I want you to actually break down the tiers, because I think a lot of people intuitively understand this, but have never seen it spelled out.
Tier 1 is your critical infrastructure. This is DNS, DHCP, and authentication. These are services where if they go down, nothing else works, and you can't even begin recovery without them. For a small network, DNS is really the kingpin here. If you run Pi-hole with Unbound, losing that means you lose ad blocking, local DNS resolution, and recursive DNS lookup simultaneously. For this tier, you do need separate hardware, or an automated failover that doesn't depend on the thing that just died.
The beauty of DNS resilience specifically is that it's absurdly cheap. The protocol itself supports redundancy natively. Every client on your network can have multiple DNS servers configured. If the primary doesn't respond within the timeout, it fails over to the secondary automatically. You don't need any fancy heartbeat monitoring. You don't need a load balancer. The mechanism is built into the thing itself.
That's worth emphasizing because it's so rare. Most protocols we deal with were not designed with redundancy in mind. HTTP doesn't have native failover. MQTT doesn't have native failover. You have to build that yourself with load balancers and health checks. DNS just has it. It's a gift from a more thoughtful era of protocol design, and we should take advantage of it.
Pi Hole on a Raspberry Pi 02W, which costs $35, draws about a watt of power, meaning roughly a dollar per year in electricity, can handle DNS for 50-plus devices with sub-10 millisecond response times. Pair that with a $5 per month VPS running a secondary Pi Hole with WireGuard back to your network for local hostname resolution, and you've got resilient DNS for less than the cost of a single larger Pi 5. The VPS also gives you an offsite resolver in case your internet connection is fine, but your internal network is down, which is helpful for diagnostics.
If you don't want a VPS subscription, a second Pi 02, what plugged into a different outlet in a different room, still costs under $40. Those two plus your main server running Pi Hole give you primary and secondary internal DNS. 2 points of failure. No cascading dependency because neither relies on the other, and the whole thing is set up in an afternoon.
Now let's move to Tier 2, services that are important but recoverable. This is your UniFi controller, your reverse proxy, your monitoring stack. These don't need dedicated hardware. They can live on the main server alongside everything else. What they need is documented recovery procedures and config backups stored somewhere that isn't the server they're running on.
Let me pull one specific example from this tier. The UniFi controller. If you run it in Docker on the main Proxmox host, with a persistent config volume, you can back up that config directory to a separate device once a week. It's a cron job. Then you have a documented restore procedure that tells you, download the UniFi controller Docker image on a laptop or a VPS, copy your config backup into the volume mount, start the container, restore from backup. That whole process takes maybe 30 minutes if you've practiced it. It's not zero downtime. This is important services, not five nines, but it's recovering from total failure in a half hour instead of hours of manual AP reprovisioning.
We should say explicitly, the UniFi controller runs perfectly fine on a $5 per month VPS with one vCPU and 1 gig of RAM, managing up to 50 access points. If you'd rather spend money than recovery time, just throw the controller on a cloud instance. Point your APs at its public IP or its tailscale address and forget about it. Now your controller is never on the same physical machine as your other services.
Tier 3 is everything else. Home Assistant, MQTT Broker, Media Servers, the convenience services. For these, downtime of hours or even a couple days is acceptable. The lights still work manually. The thermostat still has its schedule cached. You can live without Plex for an evening. These should live on the main server, be backed up regularly, and have simple recovery scripts. They do not justify the expense or management overhead of dedicated hardware.
Now we've got a framework, but applying it still leaves us with a question. The main Proxmox host is running tiers 2 and 3. If that host fails catastrophically like in our cascade, you're still down. You just have DNS and the controller still alive so that recovery is possible instead of blocked. But you're down. Is there a way to incrementally close that gap without building a 3-node cluster?
This is where I think the 2-node plus witness approach has a lot of practical merit for the sort of setup we're talking about. You keep your main Proxmox host, something with decent compute, the ZFS pools, the bulk of your VMs. Then you add a secondary mini PC, something like a B-Link N1000, which costs about $150. Sips power, but has an x86 processor and can run real virtualization. You replicate your critical VMs, DNS, maybe the UniFi controller if you're keeping it on-prem, and a Bastion VM, from the main host to this mini PC. Proxmox's built-in replication does this, no Ceph required. And then you deploy a lightweight witness. Could be another Pi, could be your VPS running a Q device that votes on Quorum.
Let's unpack the witness concept for a moment, because it sounds like magic if you haven't encountered it before. In any cluster, you need an odd number of voters to prevent split-brain scenarios, situations where two nodes can't talk to each other and both decide they should be the primary. With two nodes, you have an even number, which is mathematically incapable of resolving a tie. The witness, or Q device, is a third voter that doesn't run any workloads. It just exists to break ties. It can be absurdly lightweight. A Raspberry Pi Zero running nothing but the Corusync Kinect daemon can serve as a witness for a two-node Proxmox cluster. It uses essentially zero CPU and negligible bandwidth. All it does is say, I can see node A but not node B, so node A wins the vote.
The important thing about that setup versus the enterprise cluster is what you're not doing. You're not trying to achieve automatic failover with zero data loss. You're not running synchronous replication that demands low-latency storage networking. You're using ZFS send and receive asynchronously, meaning you might lose a few minutes of state when a failover happens, and you're manually triggering failover. For non-enterprise workloads, being able to bring DNS and the controller back up with 10 minutes of state loss is completely acceptable. You've cut the recovery time from hours to minutes for a few $100.
Here's the thing about manual versus automatic failover that I think gets lost in these discussions. Automatic failover sounds great until it fires when you didn't want it to. A network blip, a switch reboot, a brief power fluctuation, and suddenly your cluster is failing over VMs, remounting storage, and generating a cascade of alerts. For a home lab, manual failover is often preferable precisely because it doesn't trigger unless you explicitly decide the situation warrants it. You get paged, you assess the situation, you make a deliberate choice. That's not a bug. It's a feature that prevents you from waking up to discover your cluster failed over at 3 a.m. because of a transient network issue, and now you've got split-brain storage to untangle.
There's one more piece of this puzzle that I think deserves a lot more attention than it gets, the bastion host pattern. Separate from resilience, you need a way to access your network when things are partially broken. A bastion host is just a lightweight Linux box. Again, a Pi Zero or a cheap N100, running Tailscale or WireGuard. It sits there doing nothing most of the time, always online, completely independent of whatever Proxmox is doing. Its entire job is to be a jump point into your network from outside.
This breaks the specific loop we've been describing, the one where you can't SSH into the broken server because DNS is down so your laptop can't resolve the hostname. UVPN into the bastion. The bastion is already on the local network, it knows where everything is by IP, it doesn't need DNS, and you SSH from the bastion into the main server using a local IP. It cuts the Gordian knot. No dependency on the crashed services, no need for DNS resolution, just a known good path into your own infrastructure.
I want to run through a numbers comparison, because I think concrete pricing makes this feel real for people. The enterprise approach. Three refurbished enterprise mini PCs like Dell Optiplexes, 10 gig networking cards and switches, proper Ceph setup, time to configure, you're looking at $3,000 to $5,000 minimum, plus ongoing maintenance complexity. The Everything on Pis approach. Six Pi 5s or equivalent single board computers, power supplies, cases, managed switch, time to maintain them all, around $600 in hardware, plus dealing with SD card failures and the management headache.
The tiered approach we're talking about. Main Proxmox server, many people already have this piece. Pi 02W for secondary DNS, $35. Used B-Link N10 tendered or similar for a secondary node, $150. And a $5 per month VPS for offsite secondary DNS or controller failover, if you even want that. All in, maybe $250 to $300 beyond what you've already spent. And management overhead sits approximately where it was. You've added two small devices, not six, and they're both nearly zero maintenance.
I want to address a misconception that I see floating around in this space because it can get expensive fast. People will say, just use public DNS as a backup, point everything at 8888 and your internal resolver, and you're covered. The problem is that public DNS knows nothing about your internal host names. HomeAssistant.internal, Pihole.lan, Unify.local, 888 can't resolve those. If your internal DNS does split horizon resolution, different answers for internal versus external queries, public DNS substitutes won't help. And crucially, if you're running Pi-hole for ad blocking, falling back to public DNS also means falling back to no ad filtering and potentially breaking services internally that don't work outside.
This is also a good moment to address the broader survival of network management platforms. The Unify controller operates at a specific intersection of convenience and fragility. It's designed for centralized management, which is useful, but it creates a web of dependencies that becomes visible only during failure. Like all single pane of glass solutions, the weakness is that the pane of glass is fundamentally breakable, and when you break it, all you're left with is shards and a headache.
The file server anti-pattern with DNS. A lot of people run TrueNAS or a file server VM inside Proxmox that stores the VM disk images that DNS and the Unify controller use. So you have Proxmox booting, which needs the file server VM to start, which then serves storage for the VMs that depend on it. But Proxmox can't find those VMs until the file server is up, and round it goes. Untangling that dependency chain is one of the first things we'd recommend looking at.
That circular dependency is so easy to create by accident. You set up TrueNAS because you want ZFS back storage for your VMs. You put your VM disk images on a TrueNAS NFS share. Then you realize TrueNAS itself is a VM on Proxmox. Now Proxmox needs TrueNAS to be running to access the disk images, but TrueNAS is one of those disk images. Congratulations, you've built a snake that eats its own tail. The fix is straightforward. Keep your hypervisor's VM storage local to the hypervisor, and use the NAS for bulk storage, media, backups, and non-critical VM disks. But it's one of those mistakes that's invisible until the first cold boot after a power outage, at which point you discover Proxmox sitting there waiting for an NFS mount that will never appear because the VM that serves it hasn't started yet.
What's actually actionable here for someone who's listening and thinking about their own setup? I think we can boil this down to four specific things you can do this weekend.
1. Decouple DNS from everything else. Go buy a Pi02, W$35, install Pi-hole or AdGuard Home, configure it as your primary DNS, leave the secondary on your main server, or better yet, buy a second Pi and have both on dedicated hardware. This alone prevents the cascading failure that started this whole conversation. It's the cheapest insurance you can buy.
2. Document and practice your recovery procedures, not next month, before the failure. Write down the exact steps to restore your Unify controller from its backup config. Write down how to fail over DNS. Write down how to restore your reverse proxy configuration. Then do a quarterly test. I know nobody wants to do this. It's boring. It feels like administrative overhead. And it's the difference between a 30-minute recovery and an all-night rebuild. Documentation that only exists is better than plans that do not.
3. Build a break glass. Access path independent of your main infrastructure. Install Tailscale on a Pi, put it in a corner of your house, and make sure you can SSH from it into your main server using local IPs. You do not need it until you really need it. But when you need it immediately, and discovering then you never configured it properly is a uniquely frustrating experience.
4. Adopt tiered resilience as your guiding mental model. Not every service needs protection. That means dedicated redundancy. Critical infrastructure needs independent physical hardware or an automated off-site failover. Important but recoverable service needs documented recovery pathways and config backups stored somewhere safe. Everything else gets backed up regularly. That's your triage. Put your finite dollars and finite attention only where the blast radius is catastrophic.
Your minimum viable resilience checklist should be simple enough to fit in your head, secondary DNS on separate hardware, offline config backup for critical services stored somewhere other than those services if possible, a bastion host that's always online for emergency access, and whose recovery procedure for each important service you've actually tested at least once, preferably on a weekday morning with coffee.
Before we move toward closing, I want to surface something that home servers growing simultaneously more powerful ought to invite, but often doesn't get asked, as compute density keeps climbing year over year. Intel N1 point systems, the rise of AMD Phoenix mini PCs, Apple Silicon Mac minis running Asahi Linux, and increasingly versatile VM stacks. The economic pull is toward consolidating everything onto one high-powered box. And there's a genuine and growing disconnect between what's rational from a compute density standpoint and what's sensible from a resilience standpoint.
This tension isn't new, but it's accelerating. 10 years ago, a home lab was a collection of discrete boxes because that's what you could afford and that's what the hardware ecosystem supported. You had a dedicated NAS, a dedicated router, maybe a dedicated Plex box if you were fancy. Consolidation happened naturally as hardware got more capable. But now we're at a point where a single N1000 mini PC can replace 5 or 6 older machines and do it using less power than a single one of them drew at idle. The gravitational pull toward putting everything on one box is almost irresistible. And yet, the failure pattern haven't changed. One power supply failure, one bad RAM stick, one corrupted file system, and everything is gone simultaneously.
Related to that, the elephant in the room you alluded to, the next wave of home infrastructure will include AI inference, running local LLM models, local stable diffusion, the sort of on-device AI agents Apple talked about at WWDC. That requires real GPUs or unified memory architectures with substantial throughput. You can't run those workloads on a Raspberry Pi, period. So, if tomorrow arrives and suddenly you need a GPU node for your local inference server, what's your resilience strategy? Some people will spin up a dedicated inference box connected over a high-speed network to their existing infrastructure, and that will become the worst compromise of all, bringing the clusterhead's new choke point.
I think the answer there is going to look a lot like the tiered model we already described, but with a new tier zero. The GPU node is critical infrastructure for whoever depends on local inference, but it's probably not critical for DNS or basic network function. The trick will be making sure the GPU node can fail without taking DNS down with it, which loops right back to the beginning of this conversation.
One day, months, years from now, someone listening now will, on a Sunday evening 6:30, perform an entirely routine update somewhere nearby and watch as subsequent mundane clicking brings failure after failure associated indirectly with that one little routine change setting, introduced hours prior. And they will inhabit in that moment exactly the same headache our producer experienced halfway through his cascade last month. Which service dependency chain materializing out of nowhere to disable something was not in their backup plan?
Kind of captures the whole thing, doesn't it? You bulletproof one chain and a completely unanticipated orthogonal dependency, 6 degrees removed from anything that feels even vaguely adjacent, just shatters the whole illusion entirely.
As home servers absorb AI workloads, does the hunger for compute density just flush tiered resilience out the window? Or are there ways we haven't thought of yet to distribute GPU enough that you don't shatter everything into component edges the moment something straightforward happens? If you have actually experienced a cascading failure you saw coming a mile away, but also could literally do nothing to prevent, we'd hear read yours.
Quit easy thing. If this sort of episode saves you one dead night rekeying wireless configurations by starlight or ad hoc manual laptop, only restorations of exactly the settings the doc string suggests. Leaving some kind five-finger review somewhere makes it more likely. Small network operators find that same survival speed difference relatively unbloodied before they actually need it. MyWeirdPrompts.com has more. This show produced in co with Hilbert Flumingtop, brilliant logistical producer balancing. Everything before was beautifully pre-engineered, unmaintained tragedy, no overlong. Anything absurd today, goodness did something actual effectively there.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I am Herman Poppleberry, a Tier 0 correct configuration, somewhere I suspect mostly offline for best.
I am Korn. I have all services properly, actually clustered and resourced at correct priority for recovery.
Doing essentially less than that. By perfectly complete those poor decisions further next regularly.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread.
My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host.
My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.